ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 30, description by Lord Kapila of adverse fruitive activities. Today we're starting the chapter with text number 1. Kapavalahi, translation. The personality of Godhead said, as a mass of clouds does not know the powerful influence of the wind, a person engaged in material consciousness does not know the powerful strength of the time factor by which he is being carried. You can say after me. The personality of Godhead said, as a mass of clouds does not know the powerful influence of the wind, a person engaged in material consciousness does not know the powerful strength of the time factor by which he is being carried. Srila Prabhupada's report. The great politician Pandita named Chanakya said that even one moment of time cannot be returned even if one is prepared to pay millions of dollars. One cannot calculate the amount of loss there is in wasting valuable time. Either materially or spiritually, one should be very alert in utilizing the time which he has at his disposal. A conditioned soul lives in a particular body for a fixed measurement of time, and it is recommended in the scriptures that within that small measurement of time, one has to finish Krishna consciousness and thus gain relief from the influence the time factor. But, unfortunately, those who are not in Krishna consciousness are carried away by the strong power of time without their knowledge, as clouds are carried by the wind. The text again. The personality of Godhead said, as a mass of clouds does not know the powerful influence of the wind, a person engaged in material consciousness does not know the powerful strength of the time factor by which he is being carried. So Srila Prabhupada begins his comment with a wise quotation from Chanakya. Even a moment of time cannot be returned, even if one is prepared to pay millions of dollars. That means that time is priceless. One moment of time is priceless. It is the most valuable thing that we have at our disposal. And therefore, the waste of a moment of time is an incalculable loss. Once it's gone forever. So here, one has to be warned. Of course, this wisdom usually only comes with age. And as I'm 40 years old now, and as I've been getting older, this purport comes home more and more and more. And I look back now at my earlier days in Krishna consciousness, and I think how I've wasted so much time. Because at a certain age, a kind of shift in perspective takes place. I guess it happened to me around when I was in my middle 30s, maybe 33, 34, 35, there was a kind of incredible shift in perspective, which was really an eye-opener. Up until that time, I had seen my life, I was looking forward from birth. And when the shift took place, I began looking backwards, counting backwards from death. And I realized that I have a limited amount of time. Because when you're young, you know, you're immortal. You know, 40 years old, 50 years old, that's like remote, it's way off there. And you think you have endless time to squander. And you can put things off and put things off. But then when you begin to actually feel the influence of the time factor as it begins to eat away the universal cancer that devours us all, begins to eat away at your body and even your mind, and then you begin to understand that I have only so much time to accomplish. And here the accomplishment is to finish Krishna consciousness. And that's a big project. Better I should become, easier to become accomplished in Sumerian, Hebrew, and Greek. Easier to become a brain surgeon than to actually finish. I mean, there's a major project of finishing Krishna consciousness. So this wisdom only comes with age, at least to most of us, directly by our direct experience. So those of us who are younger should take advice of sadly wizened older people and learn from hearing that every moment is precious. And of course, as Prabhupada points out, how do you know you are not old? I'm thinking right now, well, maybe I've got 20 or 30 years, you know, but actually, of course, I don't know that I have 10 minutes, as a matter of fact. So one should not waste this valuable time. There's a play by Shakespeare. I know my fans would be disappointed if I did not quote Shakespeare. There's a play by Shakespeare, one of his early plays, Richard II, about a king, King Richard, who was a wastrel. He was given the position of, inherited the position of King of England. We say a big management position. And he didn't take it seriously. He was a wastrel. He had a couple of friends, I think their names were Bushby, Baggett, and Green, with whom he used to carouse and goof off while the kingdom sort of went to seed around him. And of course, naturally, there were other people who would think, wow, you know, things are being mismanaged, think this guy is no good. He's just a kind of a twit. He was a sort of a twit. Maybe even a flit, that's hinted at. But anyway, he was wasting his time. And so Bolingbroke, you know, and then they take over, he gets deposed. Bolingbroke becomes King Henry IV. And at the first part of the play, Richard is kind of just this weak, kind of lacking in strength of will, lacking in determination, wasting his time. And then after he falls down, he becomes interesting because, first of all, Shakespeare puts this incredible poetry into his mouth as he laments. You know, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories about the death of kings, you know, all of a sudden, wow. And his self-pity starts to sing like an angel. He ends up in the Tower of London, lamenting. Now, in his lament, there's this precious, there's this very, very good line. He says, I wasted time, and now doth time waste me. Because he's just wasting away in the tower. And of course, he wasted time and now time is wasting him. And that's the fate of all those who waste their precious opportunity in Krishna consciousness. So I was thinking about this factor of wasting time. Of course, you've heard it, don't waste time, be engaged always. And I was thinking about what does it really mean to waste time? How do we waste time in Krishna consciousness? More or less, what's the psychology of wasting time? And it seemed to me that the actual factor that makes us waste time, one of the major factors, is really cowardice. We shirk our duty. Just like Richard II. He had a duty to do. He was supposed to manage this kingdom, and it's just like so heavy a job, you know, too much to handle. He was supposed to surrender to the position of being king and take it over. And of course, that is very evident there. For Shakespeare, the king is God's anointed, and he is, you know, as we say, Naradeva. He's God's representative. I mean, this philosophy was there in Europe. The king is the representative of God. It's understood that if he had just put his nose to the grindstone, somehow or other he would have been given the strength to carry out this task. But he shirked it. He was deposed. And although he was a bad king, nevertheless, those people who deposed him, they had no right either. And later on, the other history plays, they get theirs. King Richard III comes on and really gives it to them. But that's another subject. It's understood that he had shirked his duty, and that actually he would have been able to have performed it had he not shirked it. I began to think of this word. This word occurred to me, one of those obsolete words in the English language, like chastity, for example, a word you can go to 12 years of school, 4 or 8 years of college, and never once hear the word chastity used in a serious context, or duty. So another old-fashioned word is courage, because it takes courage to be a devotee, and it takes courage every minute of the day. And it's actually because we are not courageous that we waste time. Kundali Prabhu and I have been talking about the image of a devotee. He's producing a BTG article on this. But as devotional service, as heroism, with reference to this phrase that comes from Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, the image, the model, a knight of faith, that's K-N-I-G-H-T, knight of faith, because devotional service is a kind of heroic. It is heroism on a day-to-day basis. And if you think of it that way, first of all, it's enlivening because you like to think of yourself as a knight. And a knight is one who you know, they're searching for the grail. And they are challenged by adversity and difficulty, who switch to their faith and perseverance and courage. They overcome this adversity and achieve the goal. This is the image we have of a knight. This kind of courageous dedication to a pious task, which is the highest ideal of chivalry. And that's what we are called to. And we are, because when you think, when people have this image of a devotee, or a saintly person, or as a holy person, who are brahminical in their qualities, and therefore they don't have those kind of manifest, you know, kshatriya qualities. Meek, quiet, mild, retiring, unassertive, unaggressive, non-violent. And of course we've been trained to think of such persons as pimps. if you look at the religious imagery of these kinds of people, you actually find out they're engaged in cosmic battle. For example, in Buddhism, you read the story of the enlightenment of Buddha. Buddha sat down under a tree in the jungle and began meditating. So all you see superficially is one skinny guy. He was very skinny at that time. One very skinny guy, he had emaciated himself, sitting under a tree. But if you read the Buddhist literature, actually there was this cosmic battle going on, because all the forces of Maya had gathered. They knew that if Buddha became enlightened, the forces of evil or Maya were going to be defeated. And so actually there was this cosmic battle going on. They wanted to stop this guy from making it to Buddhahood. And there's, led by the demoness, I think in Mara, there was this huge, you know, cosmic battle. Or if you look at Christian imagery, the painting, medieval painting or wood carving by Durier, St. Anthony in the desert. So again, here's a little hermitage in those caves, Sam, one skinny guy sitting there. But in the sky is filled with monsters. This is the devil, you know, with cloven hooves and snouts and fangs, and they're all converging on him. Because by his austerity, his penance, he's gaining spiritual power. They don't want him to be too famous, so they're all attacking him. And so we see that spiritual life actually, because everyone who's undergone spiritual life understands that we're undertaking this, that we've declared, Prabhupada says, he uses that imagery, we've declared war on Maya. And then Maya is going to fight, is going to attack, and we are called to battle. And of course, as a model for this sort of heroics, we have the life of Srila Prabhupada, presented in Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, how that was a struggle all the time. So we understand that in being called to Krishna consciousness, we're being called to a life of struggle. That is, we're being asked to surrender. And of course, the archetypical situation of being called to surrender is given to us in the Bhagavad Gita, which takes place, again, on a battlefield. And we look at Arjuna, and you can see how reluctant he was to surrender. I mean, he wasn't the ordinary, he was a Kshatriya, and these people are trained, you know, to take heart and to fight, you know, to walk into to a death trap without flinching. And yet here he was on this battlefield, and of course you kind of have to put yourself back into the situation that he was in and understand, and if you read, of course, the whole Mahabharata, you can understand the context of his reluctance to fight. We don't have strong families anymore, so we don't know what it's like to actually, you know, people are killing their fathers and children all the time nowadays. We don't have that kind of. But these were his it says cousin brothers. And that means that in Vedic system, a cousin was like a brother. And these were very, very close people. They had real fraternal relationships, which are not, you know, people are Kali Yuga families, they don't have these relationships anymore. But they had a real sense of family solidarity. And not only that, his elders, again, we don't worship elders. We don't worship teachers. I mean, for us, to, you know, worship the spiritual master is a whole big thing. There's this category of worshiping the spiritual master that comes out of the blue. And we're being called to do something that's like so unnatural to our Western mind. But of course, in Vedic situation, reverence to the teacher, even if it wasn't a spiritual master, your sitar teacher, your dance teacher, your Sanskrit teacher, any of these people, you treated them with reverence because you appreciated what a teacher does. Once in a while, in the material world, in the West, you'll even actually encounter a good teacher who will really teach you something, and naturally, that reverence, that thankfulness, is there. You've understood that this person, by their charity, has given you something that you could have in no other way attained. Some, you know, they've mastered some skill or art or knowledge, and now they're giving it to you. And you realize that if I had to get this on my own without a teacher, I would have been fated to, you know, a huge struggle now. So you're naturally reverent. So here on the other side were Arjuna's teachers. They taught him to fight, but he had that reverence. These were his elders, as he says, you know, grandfathers, fathers, worshipful elders, teachers, all on the other side, his friends. And now I'm going to kill them. So naturally he had cold feet. He didn't want to surrender. So we can understand that the process of surrender means doing something which you don't want to do. All your senses, your mind says, no! And then you do it. Anyway, that's what surrender means. And every devotee has to pass this test of surrender sooner or later. And not facing that task, and not with courage going ahead with it, that is the greatest waste of time. When you put it off, when you go to the back lines, when you retreat to the rear and sort of, maybe I'll get, of course, like, you have to understand this, for many devotees, of course, at least in the olden days, the first test, little test, but the first test for many of us was the cold shower. I don't know if they have cold showers anymore. I suspect they've gone out of fashion. But when I was a devotee, the first big test was the cold shower. And it's a small thing, really. It's not a big deal. But it's good for you because it gives you the experience of doing this. You know what it's like. It's kind of a small surrender. And all the elements are there, because the first time you encounter a cold shower, you feel the shrinking back of your flesh and your mind. You know what it's like to have every pore of your body scream, "No!" And if you're lucky, of course, you have, you know, a sannyasi, a temple president, a head brahmachari there saying, "Do it!" If you're not lucky, you know, you never get past the cold shower stage. But if you're lucky, you do it, even if somebody is there really forcing you. I remember when I was a new temple president, we used to watch the steam on the mirror. Because we knew. And I remember one brahmachari in my temple, who now was a very prominent sannyasi, I remember going in there and reaching behind the shower curtain and turning off the hot water. Because this is, you know, it's not a big thing, but it's a small thing. It really is a small thing. If for any of you it's still a big thing, you're really wasting time. Because it's a small thing, and it's not necessary that you have to do it to become Krishna conscious, but the idea is there is a test. You know, that it's a cold shower is kind of arbitrary. But just that it was, in those days it came down, this is the order of the spiritual master, you have to take a cold shower. And so therefore this was a test. And it gave you the experience of seeing what it was like to be in a situation where every pore in your body and your mind was shrieking no, and then you did it anyway. And by doing it in this small way, you got training, you saw the situation, you got a little confidence, so that bigger and bigger tests could come. And then you understood when you felt that no. Because then later, of course, the next test was go out on Sankirtan. And there was no. You know, and that surrender for us again in the early days, what our Sankirtan was, you went out and you chanted Hari Nam, no matter what the weather. And again, it was kind of arbitrary, but it was a test. Nayana Baram, our temple president, he actually bought us wool dhotis and saris. Because the thing was, you went out no matter how cold it was. I remember standing on the corner of Broad and Chestnut in a gale. I mean, our dhotis were like vertical, you know. I mean, horizontal, you know, they were out there. We used to have to pin them, you know, down because of the wind. These wool dhotis we had. And the path we were going, Hare Krishna, with these big clunky boots. And the passerbyers were going backwards against the wind. I mean, the wind was... And then people would come up to us saying, you know, I see you out there, no matter what, I can see you're really dedicated. You know? So that was another test. So we had these tests like that. So in some way or another, as you come in your career of devotional service, you'll be given a test for the spiritual master. In one form or another, it has to come. And one person's test won't be another person's test. You know? And it's kind of, in a way, it's arbitrary what it is. Like, for example, for one person, the test may be, you put in a position where you have to give orders. Now, for some people, that's not giving orders is second nature, you know. I'm just hankering to give. You know, I love giving orders. But for another person, giving orders may be very, very, very hard. But that's his test. And you're put in that test so you can overcome it. It's not that, you know, this is something you had, that giving orders is something you have to do to become Krishna conscious, like the giving orders in itself. What that is arbitrary, but that there's a test that you're given by the spiritual master. And the trouble is, like nowadays, we kind of don't recognize that test anymore. We're put in a situation where we're given a test, and the first thing we think is, oh, I'm not properly engaged. Oh, somebody's made a mistake somewhere. This is not my propensity. I have to immediately, you know, scurry back to my spiritual master or my temple president, whoever the authority who's putting me in this situation, and tell them that a mistake has been made. But actually, the mistake is not, there's no mistake, because sooner or later, I'm going to have to do that. I have to surrender to Krishna, and therefore that surrender means, that heroism, that courage means I have to pass the test. So we have to, and this idea of courage, you know, Acharya Dev has written this little book, Enlightenment by the Natural Path. So actually there's enlightenment from the dictionary, the natural, the sort of unnatural path. And I just looked up this word courage, and there's a real kind of bonus here. And it comes from the French word cœur, heart, to have heart, you know. But let me just read you this definition. I'm getting old, I'll take my glasses off. courage, mental or moral strength to venture, persevere, and withstand danger, fear, or difficulty. What is that? Mental or moral. It is a mental or moral strength. In other words, it's what we call intelligence. You know, we have this idea that there's a mental platform, and then there's the platform of intelligence. And that's what we mean by intelligence, because the mental platform, mind means accepted or rejected in terms of sense gratification. Does it feel good? Do it. Does it feel bad? Avoid it. I mean, that's where the mind is working. But the tapasya, the buddhi yoga, the yoga of intelligence, that's a synonym for Krishna consciousness, right? Buddhi yoga. The yoga of intelligence is, the intelligence, the intellectual platform is higher, that when all your mind is saying, no, it feels bad, the intelligence says, do it anyway. That's buddhi yoga. And that's that activity, that overcoming, is how we make advancement in Krishna consciousness. It doesn't come any other way. And everyone has got their test, actually their series of tests. Because after the test that ends grade one, then there's the test for grade two. And if you don't pass grade two, you never get to grade three. You have to keep coming back and be tested in the same way again and again till you get off the middle platform and do it. Then comes grade four, grade five. So we're being called to this task. This Krishna consciousness is a struggle. If it's easy, you're not doing it. It should be hard. Anyway, then it goes on. Synonyms. Courage, mettle, spirit, resolution, tenacity, the shared meaning element, mental or moral strength to resist opposition, danger, and hardship. Courage implies firmness of mind and will in the face of danger or extreme difficulty. Mettle, M-E-T-T-L-E, suggests an ingrained capacity for meeting strain or stress with fortitude and resilience. That is, you, by excessive exercise of courage, you develop metal. It becomes an ingrained capacity. Each time you do it, you become a little more courageous, and you meet the next occasion with a little more fearlessness. So that's metal. Spirit suggests a quality of temperament that enables one to hold one's own against opposition, interference, or temptation. It gives a usage, a constant, unremitting drudgery had slowly broken his spirit. They go up to the icy stream and put their toe in, oh, I can't. resolution, in other words, stresses firmness of character and determination to achieve one's end. Example, approaching an unpleasant task with resolution. These are kind of different fine shades of meaning. Same synonym of courage. And it brings out all the different aspects. Tenacity adds an implication of stubborn persistence, an unwillingness to acknowledge defeat. The antonym, the opposite word opposite in meaning they give, is cowardice. So this courageousness, this simply means the, you know, vyavadatmika buddhi, vridhavrata, we have all those words, this stern resolution, this force of duty. So this is something, we have to look on Krishna consciousness as this continual challenge. It shouldn't be that the challenge comes along as something that's an inconvenience to my service. Because what I've seen happen to devotees is that somewhere in their career in Krishna consciousness, they'll be challenged, and they won't meet that challenge. There'll be because believe me, it comes. And somewhere along the line, second, third, fourth, wherever it happens, at some point, they're given a challenge. They're given something to do that they just do not want to do. And instead of understanding, this is a test of my mettle in Krishna consciousness. This is what I need to develop. Because what comes out of it is the act or practice of surrender. It doesn't mean that once I do this, then I'm going to be stuck in some engagement I hate for the rest of my life. That's not the point. But the point is you've been given this test. So naturally it would be something that you don't want to do, that you don't like to do, that feels unnatural for you to do. But if you get away from it, you then, you know, maneuver around to avoid it, find some other engagement, go to another temple, get another authority, badger your spiritual master with letters, whatever it is, you know, retreat from the challenge. Then you find yourself a more comfortable situation in Krishna consciousness, and you go on with your sadhana, and you go on doing something useful in movement, and you make some advancement. But something has happened. And it's a kind of like, you know, there's like a grain of sand in the oyster, and this calcification starts to build up around it, and you become kind of warped in the spirit, and kind of twisted, and your Krishna consciousness doesn't really develop right. What has to happen is, again, you have to be somewhere along the line challenged. Now, every one of us can look back and see, yeah, here's a time when I did this. I'm not talking about a few weirdos, but every one of us, you know, has done this to some degree, some big in a big way, some in a small way. Those who do it in a big way, they eventually leave the movement because they're dispirited, there's nothing happening, there's no nectar. Because what happens is when you pass this test, when you jump into the icy shower, or whatever it is, the payoff is, after you do it, there's a sudden dose of ecstasy, of real Krishna consciousness, and you say, wow, that's it, that's what this is about, I've forgotten. Because Krishna always repays that. When he sees that surrender is there, there's a sudden dose of Krishna consciousness, and then you become encouraged, and at that time you say, where's the next test? Bring it on, you know. But if you shirk back, then all of a sudden Krishna consciousness becomes sort of thin tasting and not so interesting and not so dynamic and not so exciting, and I feel this kind of malaise in the movement, and I wonder what's wrong and what's wrong with everybody else and what's happened, you know. And that's because you've got to really go back. You've got to turn around. You've got to walk back the path. You've got to come to the edge of the icy stream. And this, you know, you got to dive in again. And if you're smart, you'll say, you'll ask Krishna, okay, I'm ready, I'll take the exam again. Because fortunately, you can go back and take the exam. And Krishna, you know, if you invite Krishna, okay, test me. Because, just, you know, like you may take your SAT test or some other test or your law boards. And if you flunk, you can go back. You go back, you study for a year. But, okay, so you may flunk a test. You can understand, okay, I flunked the test. Now I'm going to get myself ready for it again. You should understand what happened. You should take the remedial measures, repair your sadhana, do whatever it takes, and then ask again to be tested. And overcome that test. Take that test, and you'll pass it. And really, you see, you can do it. Because that's the cowardice. Oh, I can't do it. Yeah, maybe big, heroic devotees can do it. Maybe big Sankirtan devotees. They have the talent. They have the ability. I'm just, you know, I'm so shy, and I can't really go out and face people, and I can't really talk to them. And that Tripurari, you know, he's got the gift of gab and Irish, you know, he can, like, really rap. I can't do those things. No. You can do it. And Krishna just wants to see you try. And then he'll give it to you. Because the success is not that you become a big Sankirtan devotee. The success is you plunged in and gone ahead and you have surrendered. And then Krishna will give you everything. Maybe he won't give you the strength to do that task, but then having seen you surrendered, he'll put you in another task that you can do. But see, the point is to have you see you surrender. You may think, okay, you know, I'm not, you know, I've been given this management position. I'm not a big manager. I'm not one of those people that's got the, you know, the esprit. I don't have the charisma. You know, Krishna doesn't necessarily want to see you have the charisma, but he's put you in that situation. He wants to see you plunge in and take the bull by the horns and pick up the reins of management or whatever the task may be. And do it. And either he'll make you a manager or he'll give you something else. But that doesn't matter. The point is, you've got to do it. You've got to pass the test. He wants to see that surrender. Then you become a success in Krishna consciousness. Krishna will reward you. So you can do it. And all Krishna wants you to see is to take up the determination. Yes, I know this is hard. I know this is difficult. I know it feels dangerous. But I'm going to really persevere. And then Krishna will give you the willpower to persevere. So everyone can succeed. There's no one that can say, I don't have the moxie, I don't have the talent, I don't have the ability, I don't have the gut, or whatever, to do this. You do. You have to try. And not trying, and not keeping yourself in this fire of Krishna consciousness, that is a waste of time. And that way, years can go by without anyone making any progress in devotional service or any progress in Krishna consciousness. So every devotee should relish this test. And when you're put to a task by your Sankirtan leader, by your temple president, by your spiritual master, you know, the idea is not to find some loophole where I can get out of it, where I can somehow not do this service. And you should understand, now I'm being asked to surrender. And the fact that I don't want to do it, and I don't feel it's right, that has actually shows me that I'm being tested in the right way. That's the good thing, that's not the bad thing. So this is the way that we come to become courageous knights of faith. That we enter into the struggle of Krishna consciousness. And so people have asked Prabhupada, you know, because when we're tested, we think this is something unnatural. Devotees go to see the Prabhupada and say, why is it that there's so much opposition to this Krishna consciousness movement? Because we kind of think that, well, if I'm going to surrender to Krishna, you know, then immediately, you know, Krishna should make it easy. But the point is to make it hard. That's why there's opposition to this movement. And Prabhupada replied, well, Prabhupada said, if there is not a struggle and opposition, how can there be a glorious victory? So we should be looking forward to the glorious victory and understand that when we decide, embark upon the course of becoming devotees, we are engaging now in heroics. We're becoming like athletes. Like an athlete goes into training. He embraces pain. because he knows the pain will make him strong. He knows he will not get the endurance and the strength and the courage of heart to persevere without suffering. That's called tapasya. We are athletes of the spirit. We are soldiers in training to take this on. So we have to embrace this tapasya. And when there's, you know, if there's no tapasya, we can understand that I'm just standing on the sideline. I haven't really entered the fray, entered the battle against Maya. So we have to ask for this surrender. We should be begging for opportunity. And when something comes along that's distasteful to the mind, we should welcome this. Oh, here is the test. Now I have to overcome this. And once you have a little experience of it, you can understand. And all of us have had that experience. And we should think back as to what it was like. When I think back to the time I was really Krishna conscious, and you'll discover that that really Krishna conscious period came about because you had just endeavored to surrender and had overcome some mental reluctance, some unwillingness to surrender, and had done it, and then you were flooded with this dazzling light of Krishna consciousness, and you understood, oh, that's what it's like, that's what it's all about. And so we should welcome and ask for those opportunities. And don't be under the illusion to think that, okay, now I've surrendered, I've done something. Now it should be, you know, an easy walk. Because the one test is simply setting the stage to the next test. I assume there's a final test. But believe me, you know, that's a long way off. And so in this way, we should take heart. We should screw up our courage. We should develop our mettle and our resolution and our determination. What are those other synonyms? They're all here. We see all these things, our spirit, our mettle, our resolution, our tenacity, and, you know, and become the knight of faith, the courageous, because this is our, we are undertaking, this is the greatest heroics that is going on in this world today. And we should embrace this fully and with all determination. And understand that there's that glorious victory that's awaiting us, and there's not a one of us that cannot do it. So I'll end there. Yes. No, dispirited means it's kind of two senses of the word failure. The failure is that you withdraw from the test. That's the failure. You know, once you take the test, once you go in there, you're going to succeed, because just to do it is a success. You know, it's to sit down for the examination and take it. That's the success. You've passed. But what difficulty is when, you know, oh, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to stay back. Then you have to recognize what you've done. If you recognize what you've done, there's no need to become dispirited, because you can just apply yourself again. It's when you've done it. It's when you've been a coward and you don't acknowledge it. So there you're unconscious of what's happened, or you've made yourself unconscious of what happened. Then you become dispirited. And then you have to have somebody tell you. See, that's the advantage of Krishna consciousness. If you have proper devotee association, somebody will tell you what's going on. You don't see it yourself. You know, and it may be hard to tell you, but if you're lucky, somebody will somehow break through and let you know what's happening. There'll be more advanced devotees who know what is going on, who will be your coach. Because you require a coach. And it's up to the older devotees in Krishna consciousness to take up this coaching role for the younger. You can do it! You can do it! You know, it's one of the great experiences in American life is to really engage in athletics under a good coach. You know, some Vince Lombardi. We need these Vince Lombardis of the spirit who do that, who tell you you can win. And who would see, you know, that's the great thing about athletics, because it's a game, but in that game, you know, you can learn all the rules for victory. You know, that's why athletics are always considered good for you in material life, because that way, you know, you have, in a simplified little setting, you know, the whole thing is played out without any distractions. And that a good coach is a person that he sees, he knows your weaknesses, he knows your failings. And the coach is a psychologist who knows your weaknesses and knows your failings and knows your cowardice. And somehow or other gives you the courage to keep going. You know, and of course, you know, they have that ruthlessness that if you don't have it, okay, you leave the game, you know. They call you out of the team. When you're going to have to tackle the big guy and you don't do it, you know, you're just disgusted with him. And maybe that disgust will make you do it when you see it. Anyway, there has to be that coach. So that's the help. So the real failure is when you've been this coward. Because sometimes, you know, you may back off. And if you recognize, okay, I backed off and I've got to take this test and I'm going to get ready for it again and this time I'm going to do it, you know, then you'll be a success. There's no need to get dispirited. You know, you can understand because you have to have a knowledge of your weaknesses. A good person always knows, yet this is my weakness, and therefore deliberately works on that weakness to overcome it. That's great. I mean, you need that. It's when you have a weakness and you don't face it, you don't acknowledge it, and you don't, you know, you pretend it's not there, that's when you really fail. You know, and if you're lucky, somebody will let you know about it and help you out. But you should always be understanding to keep yourself. Because if you work really hard, if you don't waste time, that test will come again and again and again and again real fast, and you'll make rapid advancement. You're like zip through the course. So there's no need to be dispirited if, you know, you can't quite make it, so long as you understand that I got to keep applying myself to the task. But when you get dispirited is when you really fail. The real failure is that you withdraw from the contest. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's impossible to surrender too much to Krishna. And I think No, you're not going to put yourself out. Of course, that is the surrender. The surrender is you go out on a limb, and by God, Krishna takes care of you. You know, you put yourself on a risk sometimes, you know. You just walk out and you approach those people, those strangers, and you with a book in your hand. And somehow or other, you know, when you feel yourself put out in a risk, and I'm doing something I'm not capable of doing, that Krishna helps you. Yeah. Yeah, that's why you can... That's why all of us are working under authority. That's why all of us are working under authority. You need that guidance. Everybody in this movement should have a guide. If you don't have a guide, you know, formally or informally, if you don't have a guide, you're going to have a very hard time. So everyone should have somebody who's their guide in Krishna consciousness. You know, it can be your spiritual master, it can be somebody else, but that's your guide, that's your guru, your shiksha or diksha or guru. Actually, shiksha should always be there, either your diksha guru is doing it or somebody else, but you need that guide. You need somebody, you may have a friendly relationship, you may have a subordinate relationship, that doesn't matter, but there's somebody you can go to and tell them about, you know, your difficulties and your struggles and what you're trying to do, and that person can give you advice and direction. Because they have a little clearer vision either they're more advanced or they're same advancement, but they're just not you, so they don't have the same distortions that you bring to the thing, and they can help you out. So that provision is there. Yes, Kundalini? Yeah. Yeah, that's a version of shrinking back, I think. Yeah, that's another way. You know, our capacities for self-delusion are kind of enormous. To delude ourselves and delude others. And that's why you need this, somebody, you know, with a wise and cold, or at least cool vision, who can, like, you know, let you know where you're at. You should welcome that. It's really something, and this is a large part of the context of what we're talking about. I know this is going really late, but criticism, it's so valuable. It really is. Of course, now we can resent criticism, and both of us, we have to learn how to give it and how to take it. And this is something I've learned, like, for example, in academic life. A person who's really, you know, like a philosopher or a scholar of some kind, a good scholar wants and values more than anything good criticism. And I've seen that, you know, I gave a paper at a conference, a religion conference, and it was just a short paper, but it was, then they asked me to expand the paper into an article so it could be printed in a book, a collection of scholarly articles about religion. It's a paper on deity worship, about deity worship and Krishna consciousness, trying to explain what it meant. There's a book about, you know, the deity in India. What does it mean? How do you explain this to Westerners? So they wanted it from a devotee's point of view. And a large part of this paper is a sustained argument against Mayavadi philosophy, which is one of the biggest misunderstandings of the deity. So I gave this essay, and then the editors of the book, one that's real hot shot from the University of Chicago, with, you know, a mind like a razor blade, and two other people, we say steel trap, but it's more like a razor blade, and two other people, you know, went over the talk I gave, and they really, like, you know, laid into it. You know, this is, you did this, you did this, you didn't make, you left this out, this out, this, you arguing against a straw man, you know. And it was great, because then I could take this criticism, and using it, I could, when rewriting the paper, I turned out a much, much better paper than I could ever have done without that criticism. So that criticism was valuable. And although these people were attacking my paper, I knew it was well meant. Because they were doing it so that I would make a better paper. And sometimes, like, I had a big argument against Mayavadi philosophy, so this guy, professor in the University of Chicago, said, "You're setting up a straw man." They don't really say this. You know, the straw man argument, where you invent a stupid opponent in order to defeat your opponent. So he said, "You're setting up a straw man." So I got down to Shankaracharya's Bhagavad Gita commentary, I went through it, and darn, he was saying the same thing. It wasn't a straw man. So the guy was wrong. But still, instead of having my own paraphrase, I just quoted Shankaracharya. You know, so that made it stronger, because they realized, well, this is not just Shankaracharya saying this. Okay, you know. What can they do? So that was an improvement, even though that guy's criticism sort of wasn't right on. It still helped me make a better argument, because I knew that some people will think this is a straw man, so I better bolster it, you know. So in that way, all that criticism was valuable. And those people that gave it to me, they, you know, Some of them may, you know, had some, you know, some of them may have been, you know, didn't like devotees very much. That didn't matter. Either way, it was valuable. So every devotee should be wanting that criticism. You should desire it. But because we, you know, we have these touchy false egos, when you're going to give criticism, you should also do it in that way. You should give criticism in the spirit that you're a fine devotee, and I can see that a lot of your greatness is not really coming out, and I want to help you manifest that greatness more. You're in that spirit of wanting to help the person, not that you want to, boy, what a, you know, I'm just going to annihilate you. Because nobody wants to be annihilated. You know, you're not going with the spirit of annihilating the person. You're going with the spirit of making them even bigger and better and more real and more substantial than they are manifesting now. So that's the way it should be. We have to learn how to do that and how to take that. And that way we'll all help each other. And boy, we need that help. You know, we're like a bunch of cripples, but you kind of link arms and you all can walk. That's the Sankirtan movement. You go back together, go back to God, it all together. Because by ourselves, none of us could make it at all. Any other comments or questions, observations? Yes, please.
Is there a legitimate use for putting back in off?
It tends always to be destructive, but you have to understand what's backing off. I mean, you don't. You know, if you, sometimes you have to do this under guidance. It's not that by your mental concoction you decide this is the test. And you encounter a tiger on the path, and you decide, I've got to make this tiger Krishna conscious by touching it and chanting the holy name. See, that's a mental concoction. So the test is not a mental concoction. It comes to you. It is the test of the spiritual master. And if you're given the test by the spiritual master, then backing off is always wrong. You have to apply yourself. You know, if the spiritual master is telling you to do something that seems to be impossible, you can go to him and say, this seems to me to be impossible. And the spiritual master, 9 times out of 10, is going to say, no, it's not impossible. Like Prabhupada told Srila Rameshwar, I want all the Chaitanya Charitamritas published in, what was it, 6 months or something? 2 months, yeah. 2 months. Impossible. Prabhupada, that is a word in a fool's dictionary. You know, and Srila Ramastar still remembers that as the high point, because they all surrendered and did it. And their first attempt was, you know, back off, back way off. Don't even think about it. So, you know, you can go to the spiritual master, oh, this is impossible. And then you hear what his response is. Maybe he'll look at you and decide, okay, I give it, so do it this way, or he'll give you some direction. Or he'll, you know, but so you can talk about it. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know. But the first thing is you apply yourself. How can this be done? Tamal Krishna Maharaj was given the task by Srila Prabhupada to preach in China. The first thing he did is make a big study, and he decided there was no way to get in there. But he's persevering, and, you know, he's finding ways. He's finding ways. At first it looked impregnable. But then, you know, came the thaw, and you know, Mao Zedong died, and you know, and the capitalist rotors became a little more prominent, and they opened up a little bit, and, you know, he's finding ways. But the thing is, you got to persevere, even if it looks impossible, you got to use your intelligence. How can I do it? How can I do it? Day and night you'd be thinking, how can I do it? How can I do it? And then, you know, the answers will come. Maybe from an unexpected direction, but you have to have that application. And you got to keep your nose to the grindstone. That's my understanding. I better stop. I'm getting a signal from the wing. Glory to the Prabhupada.